So welcome back. This is another lecture on gravitational waves. So today we open a new chapter. Finally, we're going to applications and apply what we have learned so far about gravitational waves now to several astrophysical systems. So what we are studying are idealized astrophysical systems. So we will talk about binary systems. Which means two masses orbiting each other, spinning rigid bodies, and a body falling into a black hole. And an accelerated mass, which is accelerated by some external force and then generates gravitational waves. Accelerated mass, which is accelerated by an external force. Okay, so let's start with the first one, in spiral. In spiral, of course, of compact stars. Compact binaries. Okay, so compact binaries would of course be two black holes or a neutron star and a black hole or two neutron stars. So far in our discussion we are pretty generic as we're just looking at the first time of the in spiral of compact binaries, not the final ones, and there we just need the masses basically and assume the particles are or the masses are point-like. So it could be anything. Boson stars, dark matter stars, everything which has a mass and is compact will all be the same. So we consider, again, masses M1 and M2 at points R1, R2. Yeah, we can basically repeat much of the stuff we have done in the previous chapter on two masses orbiting each other. But now we are more specific. So we have the center of mass system. We introduce the two masses out of the two individual masses. So one is, of course, the reduced mass. So we have a reduced mass. Mu, which is defined as m1 m2 divided by m1 plus m2, and we have the total mass. Capital M, which is the sum of the two individual masses. Okay? For simplicity, we're looking at circular orbits. Or quasi-circular orbits, so basically the emission time is shorter than the time it takes for one orbit, so we can assume these are quasi-circular orbits, quasi-stationary orbits, and then we can just use Keplerian laws or Newtonian mechanics. So the velocity squared over r is then equal gm over r squared. So the equality of forces gives us the circular orbits. Yeah, the gravitational force is equal to force from a rotation. And then velocity is the frequency of the orbit times r, the orbital frequency. And then basically, plugging everything in, we get that omega s squared is equal gm over r cubed, which is basically Kepler's law. Yeah. Kepler's law. Okay. So now we introduce a new mass, which is specific for gravitational waves. This is the Chirp mass, and you probably have heard about it. We introduce now the infamous Chirp mass. So whenever you read now the new article about a gravitational wave event GW170817, you hear about a Chirp mass and that they can very precisely determine the Chirp mass, but not the individual masses. And everybody's asking, why is this Chirp mass, this funny combination of the two masses? And the answer comes now. And it's not known to everybody working in the field, but we know the answer. So the Chirp mass is defined as the following funny combination. MC, or M chirp, is the reduced mass to the power of 3 over 5 times the... Did I use a small m for the total masses? I do. So that should be consistent. This is the total mass, so this should be also, I'm sorry, a small m, not a capital M. Thereafter. The total mass to the 2/5 power. This is a very funny combination, but you see the units are right. This has unit of mass. This has unit of mass to the power 3/5 plus 2/5. So this is 5/5. So this also has dimension of mass on the right-hand side. So far, so good. But why this funny combination? We can rewrite this, which doesn't really help much. This is m1 times m2 divided by m1 plus m2. And the product is to the power of 3 over 5, and the total mass is 1 over 5. Okay. We know from last section, from section 3, we know what the amplitude is in gravitational wave amplitudes. We know the amplitudes of two masses orbiting each other. We just have been talking about in the exercise yesterday. Yeah. So there we find the following combination. If you look at h plus as a function of time, you find that is proportional to a combination which is the gravitational constant, the reduced mass, omega s squared, which comes from the double time derivative of the mass moment, times r squared, yeah, which comes the, where r is the orbital radius. Now this we can transform in the following way. We can plug in now the orbital radius r. Yeah. So this is g mu omega s squared, and r squared now is, let's see, what is r squared? Gm omega s. this is G M over omega S squared. And then we have to take it to the power of 2/3. Right? So we're just replacing R from here. Let's draw a line here. This is this. Okay?
Good.
So then this is proportional to. So we get another G, which is G to the 1 plus 2/3. This is G to the 5/3. G to the 5/3. Then we have the reduced mass mu. Let's put omega s squared to the front first. Omega s squared, and then we have omega s squared to the 2/3. So this leaves omega s squared to the 2/3, which is omega s to the 4/3. Omega s to the, no. Omega s to the 2/3, I'm sorry. Squared to the 1/3, yeah. Omega s to the 2/3 remains. And then we still have the reduced mass mu, and m goes like the power of 2/3. M to the 2/3. Yeah? Okay, so the amplitude is proportional to the reduced mass mu times the total mass to the 2/3. Now this has dimension of 5/3 in mass. So this one here, we rewrite as a mass to the power of 5/3. Okay, and that we call the chirp mass. This is the mass scale which enters the amplitude. Yeah, so this would be the true definition of the chirp mass. The chirp mass to the 5/3 is equal to the reduced mass times the total mass to the 2/3.
But why did we define this as to the power of 5/3?
To get the units right.
Okay.
Yeah, to get the units right. Because we have g to the 5/3 here. So it's always then g times m gives the correct units. So it goes like g times m to the power of 5/3. Which is just a combination of, you have the amplitude, which is proportional to g, and you have this orbital dependence, which goes like g to the 2/3, and that gives in total g to the 5/3. That's the reason. Yeah. So, and this is the chirp mass. And now if I take the root, make this to the power of 3/5, then we see this is mu to the 3/5 times m to the 2/5. Okay, so this is the chirp mass. So this is how it comes in, into the game. Yeah, so the amplitude really just depends on the chirp mass, and that's also all they can basically determine from the gravitational wave amplitude looking at a neutron star merger or a black hole mergers, basically. So they need then, for black holes, if they can really see that they merge with each other, they get higher orders, corrections to this quasi-circular orbit, so then they can also determine the individual masses. But in this case, for the neutron star, they just observed the very few of the circular orbits, and then they couldn't see anything because the frequency went up, was too high. So they cannot see higher order corrections to it. So the first order correction is always just proportional to this chirp mass. So they can only determine the chirp mass very precisely. And that is given to within a few percent or so, the chirp mass, 1.22 solar masses or so for the chirp mass. But they don't know what the individual masses are. Yeah. Of course, one can give constraints, reasonable constraints. We know neutron star masses are in the range between 1 and 2 solar masses. So you can make some educated guesses, what is the most likely one, and so on. And then they come up with the result that the most likely total mass is 2.7 solar masses. But the error bar is larger. Okay, so the chirp mass. So let's put it like this. So we can write down the amplitudes. Now with this at hand, we can rewrite the amplitudes we have derived in the last section, the last chapter. And we see the following, that h plus as a function of time is given by 4 over r, g times the chirp mass over c squared to the power of 5/3. Okay. Then we have a frequency in gravitational waves, so we just rewrite it in the frequency, we rewrite omega s in the frequency. So this is that's how the pi enters, and this goes to the power of 2/3, we have just seen. Then we have some angular dependence, cosine theta squared over 1/2. And then we have the cosine of 2 pi f of the gravitational wave times the retarder time plus some offset 2 phi. And we have the other amplitude h cross has the same prefactors, 4 over r gm chirp mass over c squared to the 5/3. Of course, the same dependence on the frequency goes like the frequency to the power of 2/3. The angular distribution is slightly different. There's a cosine theta here. And then we have, instead of the cosine, we have the sine, 2 pi f gravitational wave times the retarder time plus some offset in the angle phi. Okay, this is just taking over from the solution of the last section on two masses orbiting each other. Yeah. So this is correct for the first in spiral for black holes and for neutron stars, and also for mixed ones, a neutron star with a black hole, and so on. Yeah. So here the frequency in a gravitational wave is defined as omega in the gravitational wave over 2 pi. And now we know that the omega in the gravitational wave is 2 times omega s. That we know, it's twice the orbital frequency. Okay, questions to this result? No. Okay. Now we can rewrite this in terms of the Schwarzschild radius. So we introduce now a Schwarzschild radius for the chirp mass, introduce Schwarzschild radius of the chirp mass. So why not? So then we have the Schwarzschild radius of the chirp mass would be 2gm chirp over c squared. Okay? And we can also introduce a reduced wavelength. Reduced wavelength because we divide by 2 pi. So this is lambda bar. So this is lambda over 2 pi. Lambda bar is defined as c over omega gravitational wave. So it just gives us basically a length scale of the gravitational wave. Okay. Then we can rewrite h plus of t as having an amplitude, an angular dependence which goes like 1 plus cosine theta squared divided by 2, and the time dependence which goes like cosine of omega gravitational wave t retarded time plus 2 times angle phi, and the same for the h plus of t, the same amplitude. But here we have now a cosine theta and a sine omega gravitational wave t retarded time plus 2 times phi. Okay, and the amplitude A is equal 1 over 2 to the 1/3. And then it's the ratio of the Schwarzschild radius to R that takes care about this 1 over r factor. And the other dimension is from the frequency. This is rc over lambda bar to the 2/3. This is the frequency dependence. Yeah. So now we know that H is dimensionless. It's a dimensionless quantity. So A is also dimensionless, right? So this is why we can really write everything in ratios of quantities, in dimensional quantities. So we see that the amplitude depends linear on the distance, and it depends basically, it's given, one can give a rough estimate on the amplitude by looking at the typical scale of the problem, which is the Schwarzschild radius of the chirp mass, which would be then for the sun, it's 3 kilometers. For the chirp masses we usually have, it will be in a range of a few kilometers, and the distance to the object, which is then in light years. So now we can make estimates on how large this amplitude has to be. If we say that the typical wavelength we're looking at, the typical frequency, is at the scale of basically the Schwarzschild radius in the range of a few kilometers. And the arm length of the gravitational wave detectors are in the range of a few kilometers. So this is of order one, this ratio here, the reduced wavelength of the gravitational wave and the scale we have from the Schwarzschild radius of the chirp mass. Yeah. So if R is, say, what do you have, 40 megaparsec we had for this gravitational wave event, right? 40 megaparsec. Megaparsec. Now this is 40 times 10 to 6 times 3, approximately, light years. And the light year is, one light year is, we want to have it in kilometers, right? So this is 300,000 kilometers, 3 times 10 to 5 kilometers per second, times, how many seconds do we have for 1 year? How many seconds has a year? It's 3 times 10 to 7 seconds. So this is at the order of 10 to 13 kilometers. 10 to 13 kilometers. So this is at the range of, so this is 10 to 7 with the 3, this is 10 to 8. With that one, it's 10 to 21. 10 to 21 kilometers. Yeah. So we see the amplitude we are going to measure is basically here. A is at the order of 10 to minus 21. That's the rough estimate for the gravitational wave. Yeah. So you can make similar estimates now for the black hole merger events, which happened at, 100 or 200 megaparsec distance. You can make similar rough estimates. So 10 to minus 21, this is the ballpark we are talking about for the gravitational wave amplitude. You could have guessed this actually just by dimensional reasoning. So what those gravitational wave detectors measure are the amplitude. They don't measure really the energy in a gravitational wave or the flux. They measure the amplitude. Now the amplitude goes down like 1 over r. The amplitude squared would then be the energy or the flux we measure for photons or for light. So whenever we measure photons, the flux goes down like 1 over r squared, which we measure in the detector. But gravitational waves only go down linear with the distance, like 1 over r. Right? You know that. It just is the statement here in this formula. And the typical scale we have to compare that. We know h is dimensionless, so we need another scale to compare with. And that's the typical scale we're talking about. You can take maybe, instead of the Schwarzschild radius, you can take the size of the system, which would be not much different. Yeah? But the typical scale would be the Schwarzschild radius we have, or the sizes of the objects, which is a few kilometers, say 10 kilometers, or just 1 kilometer, divided by r. This gives then a typical estimate for the gravitational wave amplitude. Good. Questions? No. Yeah. So let's look at the power in gravitational waves. Power is energy per unit time. The power in gravitational waves. So dp over d omega, and that we have also derived in the last section, is 2 over pi c to the fifth power divided by g. And then gm chirp omega gravitational wave over 2 c cubed to the power of 10^3 times a theta dependence, and the theta dependence is just the square of the two dependences we had in the other formula, which I just erased, unfortunately. So the g of theta is 1 plus cosine squared theta divided by 2 squared. This was from the h plus amplitude, plus a cosine squared theta from the h cross amplitude. Okay, and just in brackets as a note, so if you go back to your notes, you find that this actually is proportional to g mu squared r to the fourth power, so it's the square of the whole expression, omega s to the sixth power. Right? So this is why instead of the 5/3, this is goes like the squared, so this is why it has to go like 10/3. Yeah, but you can do the exercise again. You come up with a g mu squared omega s to the sixth power. We plug in r, which is then g m to the 4/3 times omega s to the minus 8/3. And then you combine everything and you find this goes like 1 over g. And then g to the 10/3, omega s to minus 10/3, and the mu squared m to the 4/3, which can be combined to a chirp mass of 10/3. So this is how you can derive the equation above. So this goes really like the chirp mass times omega to the 10/3. Okay. Good. So what we actually did is, where another note is that we did some averaging over time for the power. That when we average over cosine squared of 2 omega t plus 2 phi, then this is a half, independent of phi, the offset phi. Okay. So we can do now the angular average of this whole thing, and then we get the total power. Angular average, so then the total power emitted is 32 over 5, c to the 5, 1 over g, g times the chirp mass times omega in gravitational waves over 2 c cubed to the power of 10/3. Yeah, what you get is, as a side remark, that d omega over 4 pi times g of theta is 4 over 5 by doing the angular average. Okay, so far so good. So we get this funny power in the power in gravitational waves. It goes like the frequency to the power 10/3. So next we can look at the source of radiated energy, and the source of the radiated energy has to come somewhere. We have energy conservation. In that case, it comes from the orbital energy. or the binding energy of within your orbit. So the source of radiated energy is the orbital energy. The neutron stars or the black holes are not losing mass, but the energy comes from the orbital energy or the potential energy. Orbital energy. So the orbital energy orbit is equal to the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. And if the whole thing is virialized, we can use the virial theorem. And we know that this is then equal minus a half the potential energy, which is G M1 M2 over 2R, basically. Okay. Okay. What does it mean if we are losing orbital energy that the radius must decrease? There's a negative sign here. The radius must decrease in time to compensate the loss in energy. Loss in gravitational waves. Yeah. So this means omega s increases, obviously. The orbit, the time the two masses orbit around each other goes down, so omega s increases. Then as omega s increases, omega the power will increase. Power increases with some power which is even larger than omega to the third, with the third, more than the third power, it goes like omega to the 10th third. And then R has to increase more, has to decrease more. More, and so on and so on. Dots, dots, yeah. So the whole thing really blows up. So one says the two masses coalesce, there's coalescence of the system. And it goes more rapidly and rapidly the closer they get to each other. Okay, so I think this is clear. You have seen the picture before when discussing gravitational waves, but now it's really spelled out in detail by knowing that the power really increases more than linear with the frequency. What we assumed in our derivation was, what I stated in the beginning, that we have a quasi-circular motion. So we said basically that R is constant. We always use that R is constant and plug it in from the Kepler's law by using circular orbits. So in fact, we have quasi-circular motion. As the orbit shrinks. And we can specify that as long as the change in frequency, omega s, is much, much smaller than omega s squared. So why omega s squared? Because then we get the right units on both sides. Yeah, so the change in omega must be smaller than the corresponding quantity in omega s, which would be omega s squared. Now, from the relation that omega s squared is proportional to r to minus 3, we can derive the following equation. And this is the usual trick we know from astronomy. We look at the logarithmic derivative of those two. We see what the power is. The power is minus 3/2, basically, if you plug the two to the other side. Right? Omega s is proportional to minus 3. Or if we take the logarithmic derivative, so this means if we say that d log omega s divided by d log r, this is r over omega s, d omega s over dr. Yeah. And the logarithmic derivative just gives the power, which is minus omega s. Now I have to be careful. 3 over 2. Is that clear? Not really. Okay, you take the logarithm of both sides, then you get a 2 here and a minus 3 here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And then you take the ratio of those two, it's minus 3/2. But this is equal to this expression. The logarithmic derivative is just this expression here. Okay, so we can write down a differential equation in terms of dr over dt. Yeah? And we can say that r dot is equal to minus 2/3, reverting the expression, times r, omega s dot over omega s. Right? Good. So we can rewrite that equation in the following form. R dot is then equal minus 2/3 r omega s dot over omega s squared. And from this it follows that basically r dot is much, much smaller than minus r omega s for our initial conditions we have written down here, that omega dot s is much, much smaller than omega s squared. Yeah? So if this is much smaller than 1, then basically the r dot is much smaller than this one. Good, so now we eliminate the radius r in favor of another quantity, in favor of omega in gravitational waves. So we have to do some transformation for doing this, but maybe I'll leave this as one of the exercises. So the orbit is then given like minus g squared mc to the 5th power omega squared in gravitational waves divided by 32 to the power of 1/3. So now we equate both energy terms. So we have the loss in energy in gravitational waves, which is equal to the loss in the orbital energy, which is dE orbit divided by t. Now this, the only time dependency we really have is the omega in gravitational waves. The trapped mass does not change, and g does not change. Usually it does not change. So this goes like omega g gravitational wave. This goes like 2/3. So what remains then is a minus 1/3. So this goes like omega gravitational waves to minus 1/3 times omega dot in gravitational waves. Now we can plug everything together. We know the power in gravitational waves, which we have calculated, which was this omega to the 1/3 power. We have the minus 1/3 on this side, so the whole thing goes like omega to the 11/3. So omega dot in gravitational waves is equal 12 over 5, 2 to the 1/3. Then we have g times the trapped mass divided by c cubed to the power of 5/3. Omega gravitational waves to the power 11/3, and here this we mark with a star. Yeah. Okay. So this is a differential equation. We can solve that differential equation immediately, and then see how the frequency changes with time. So we can write down the solution in terms of the frequency, f gravitational wave, which is omega gravitational wave divided by 2 pi. This is supposed to be a g here. And then we find the frequency of the gravitational wave as a function of time is 1 over pi in this quasi-circular approximation, which is 5 over 265 tau to the power of 3 over 8 times the trapped mass to the power of minus 5 over 8. And tau is the time to coalesce. This is the time to coalescence. This is basically tau is t coalescence minus t, the time to coalescence. Okay. Good. Everything clear so far? Yeah, so I guess we stop here, have a short break, and then we're doing some estimates for the purpose of looking what are the typical frequencies and the typical frequency changes for LIGO in terms of neutron stars merging. Okay, let's have a break. Okay, let's start now, then we can stop a little bit earlier. So let's do some quick estimates on our nice formula and see what are the typical frequencies we can expect and what are the range of frequencies to be expected from this in spiral. So we're looking at an in spiral for masses for typical neutron stars. And 1 equal M2 equal 1.4 solar masses. So for basically we're looking for neutron stars. Then we can calculate the trapped mass, and the trapped mass is around 1.2 solar masses. So these are the typical trapped masses we expect, and that's in fact also what they have seen, something like 1.2 as a trapped mass in the gravitational wave event. So we can compute now the frequency in gravitational waves as a function of tau in this quasi-circular approximation. And one gets 130 hertz for those typical values, and this is the typical astrophysical notation. So we put in for the chirp mass 1.2 solar masses. This goes like the power of minus 5/8. And tau goes like 1 second over tau. This goes like the power of 3/8. Okay. So if we are still 1 second away from coalescence, one sees a gravitational wave with a frequency of 130 hertz. Or in other terms, we can reshuffle everything in terms of tau. So tau is around 2.2 seconds. If we assume the same chirp mass, 1.2 solar masses, and this goes to the power of 5/3, for a typical frequency of 100 hertz now. 100 hertz, half gravitational wave, 8/3. So we can look now at the typical frequencies we can measure with LIGO. So the lowest frequency LIGO can measure, and also GEO-600. LIGO and GEO-600 is around 10 hertz. Yeah, and then up to 1 kilohertz. And 10 hertz, this corresponds to a time tau of around 17 minutes. Yeah. And if we say now we have a frequency of 1 kilohertz, they are close to the merger, we're talking about milliseconds here, then the orbital radius is at the range of 30 kilometers. So if you see gravitational frequencies up to a few hundred hertz, then we're really approaching orbital radii in the range of maybe just a few hundred kilometers. So this cannot be white dwarfs. This must be compact objects, neutron stars. Neutron stars have radii of typically 10 to 15 kilometers. So if we take 2R, we're talking about 10 to 30 kilometers. So this is basically the point where the two neutron stars are touching each other, the typical frequency of 1 kilohertz. Yeah, so here, neutron stars touching each other. Typically. So just as a reminder, for gravitational wave 1708-17, the maximum frequency they could observe was around 400 hertz. This is what they have seen. Then they were running out of sensitivity. So the sensitivity goes up with higher frequency. So, I mean, if it goes to higher frequency, they are less sensitive, so they couldn't see any gravitational wave anymore, unfortunately. So they could not see that the two neutron stars are touching each other. That was before touchdown. So this is clear. Here, this was before touchdown. Yeah, so in fact, you can describe very well the gravitational wave frequency in terms of quasi-circular orbits. It works pretty well. You can look for deviations from these quasi-circular orbits, and deviations from this quasi-circular orbit, and this will be discussed then in next semester, in our next lecture on gravitational waves, which I do part two. Then if you are corrections, then you have extended objects, and they can be deformed due to some gravitational potential and the presence of the other neutron stars. They can be deformed in the plane. And the the amount of this deformability, of course, depends on whether the two neutron stars have soft material or stiff material. So if the neutron star is very stiff, they do not deform. So you don't see any deviations from the gravitational wave signal. If they are very soft, they can be squished together, and then suddenly you see, there's an offset in the gravitational wave signal. They have not seen any deviation. So they could set up a limit on the tidal deformability. So this means soft equations of state are ruled out because they measure this tidal deformability must be smaller than a certain number. So one can also make a constraint then on the radius. So LIGO actually then, if you do a detailed calculation, you find actually that the radius of a neutron star, the maximum radius of a neutron star around this mass value is around 13 kilometers. Or say it in other terms, the radius of a neutron star must be smaller than about 13 kilometers. This is what has been inferred from the gravitational wave signal here from GW 170817. Okay, this was also work done here in Frankfurt in collaboration with the group of Luciano Rezzola, Elias Most, and Lucas Y, where essentially in figuring out this constraint on the radius. Okay. Good. So let's talk about the number of cycles in the detector bandwidth. This is the observationally important. So how many cycles can be observed in the detector bandwidth. Yeah, so in the range where the detector can really see something, so the number of cycles we can define as an integral from minimum time to the maximum time the observation can be performed, integrate over dt, and the frequency of the gravitational wave, which depends on time. Yeah, and that we can recast now an integral in the frequencies, so there's a minimum frequency and a maximum frequency, and we integrate over the frequency in gravitational waves. And this goes like F gravitational wave over F dot in gravitational wave. So let's put in typical numbers. We have 10 hertz and a kilohertz. Actually, we can ignore the upper limit. We just say that F max is much larger than F min. And then one finds this is 1.6 times 10 to 4 for a minimum frequency of 10 hertz to the power of 5/3. Now we just have to plug in the differential equation, F dot over F, and it goes with the chirp mass, 1.2 solar masses over the chirp mass to the power of 5/3. Okay. So this is in term of F min for LIGO. So we see LIGO sees hundreds of cycles if you have the typical chirp mass. So LIGO is sensitive to chirp masses at the order of one solar masses, and maybe slightly larger ones, maybe 10 also. They have seen black holes merging with 20, 30 solar masses. And for LISA, which goes into orbit in 10, 15 years or so, the minimum frequency is something at the range of 10 to minus 4. Hertz. Be some unit. So then it means this is sensitive to much larger masses. So this is sensitive to chirp masses. Also there, they were measured chirp masses of 10 to 5 solar masses. Yeah, so these are supermassive black holes, basically, we're talking about. Supermassive black holes start at 10 to 6 solar masses, up to 10 to 9, maybe 10 to 10 solar masses. So these are small supermassive black holes, like the ones we have in the core of our galaxy. So these are massive black holes. Yeah, so if we put in M1 equal M2 equal 10 to 6 solar masses, then the number of cycles is around 600. But we can also put in M1 equal 10 to 6 solar masses and say now M2 is another compact star, a neutron star, or maybe a white dwarf, which has one solar masses, then the chirp mass is around 10 to 3 solar masses, and the number of cycles is even larger, is 10 to 8 cycles. Yeah. So you can work out different constellations, but these are the most interesting ones. A massive black hole with another massive black hole can be observed by LISA, but as well they can see actually also when a compact star is swallowed by a massive black hole. Then we see that in gravitational waves. Good questions?
Where there are different.
So the question was about the observed black hole mergers observed by LIGO in the last years. Most of them are in the range of say 20 to 50 solar masses, so they have quite similar masses. Yeah. So not unequal masses. Maybe the difference is by a factor 2 or so, but not more than that. It's not orders of magnitude different. Okay, let's look in detail how the radius change with time, and here I mean the orbital radius. So r dot over r, we have seen before, this goes like the power of minus 2/3 times omega dot gravitational wave over omega gravitational wave. Okay, now we can plug in the differential equation we had before. We use star. We could also use the solution above there, but this, we don't need this one. And this gives then minus 1 over 4 tau. Yeah. And we can integrate that differential equation. Yeah, it goes like 3 over 8, right? That's the right power. Okay. Yeah, we, just to be precise, if we have omega dot over omega is 3 over 8, 1 over tau, right? The power we have, the dependence on tau was minus 3 over 8, 1 over tau. Okay, we can integrate the differential equation, then R of tau is equal R0, and then this goes like tau over tau 0 to the power of 1 over 4. Okay, that's clear. Good. So how does it look like if we make a plot? The radius over tau, or time. Let's put in time. And then first there are hardly any changes, and then suddenly it goes down, goes down, and goes down like this. 1 over 4th power. And it goes very steeply down because it goes like the 4th power, so it's not a parabola. So it goes really steep down. And this then is called the plunge phase. So they're orbiting each other, slowly coming closer, and then suddenly zoop, they're really merged with each other. That's why it's called the plunge phase, so they really dive into each other. So for the time to coalesce, tau 0, we can calculate now tau 0, this is this plunge time here, tau 0, it's 5 over 265, c to the 5th power, r0 to the 4th power, divided by g cubed, m squared times mu. We can introduce now the quantity, the orbital period. Orbital period, the initial one. Initially, the tau 0 is defined as 2 pi over omega s at tau 0. And then the tau 0 we can compute is then given by 10 to 7 years for an initial period of 1 hour to the power of 8/3, and then the total mass to the power of 2/3, and the reduced mass to the power of 1. Yeah, so this now does not really depend on the trip mass, but on some other combinations of the mass. And that, yeah, we can put into brackets. Okay, so it takes about 10 million years for two neutron stars to coalesce. This is the typical time scale. If you look at the observed double pulsars we know, and there are about half a dozen double pulsars we know about, or double neutron star systems to be more precise, we see that the orbital period is around a few hours. So all of these coalesce within a few million years, 10 million years, that's a typical time scale for the coalescence time. Yeah. One can also estimate how many of these neutron star mergers one has in our galaxy. And typically, if we just make a rough estimate how many binary systems we have in neutron stars, then every 10 to 5 years or 10 to 4 years within a galaxy, we have a neutron star merger for a typical galaxy. So if you observe 10 to 4 to 10 to 5 galaxies, we will see each year, we will see a gravitational wave merger. We will see a merger in a gravitation wave signal. So if LIGO is measuring now up to the Coma cluster, so beyond the Virgo cluster, to when the Coma cluster has a distance to 100 megaparsec, There we have several thousand galaxies, so they will see typically one event per year. So in the next run, they will see maybe even a few, not only one, but maybe even a few neutron star mergers. So if we are lucky, we need to be lucky, but we are looking forward to. So any more questions to the plunge phase, coalescence time scale? Okay. Yeah, we still have some more time. Great. So let's look at the waveform of this gravitational wave merger. Waveform of gravitational wave. So we have x of t is r of t times the cosine of phi of t divided by 2. And we have y of t, this is r of t, and then the sine phi of t divided by 2. Okay, and we introduced the factor 2 for phi because we want to write it in terms of the frequency in gravitational waves. So this goes from tau 0 to tau, to t. dt prime omega s of t prime, which is then the integral over omega in gravitational wave as a function of t prime from t0 to t. So we have done this before. There are three differences to the standard waveform we discussed before. Omega gravitational wave times t. This is what we had before. We assumed that omega does not depend on time. Now the whole thing depends on time, so we have a general angle phi, which depends on t. Yeah. More generically, if we look at our amplitude, it goes also proportional to the omega of the gravitational wave to some power. So we also have to replace omega gravitational wave with a time-dependent frequency. And in addition, we have now time derivatives. Time derivatives of omega gravitational wave and of the orbital radius r. Now to change the last one, this can be ignored. First approximation. Ignore in first approximation. As we argued before that r dot is small, is negligible as long as omega dot is small. And we are really looking at the waveform just before the plunge phase, so the initial one here. This is the part we're looking at. So we're looking at this part where R basically does not change here, this part here, yeah, before the plunge phase, which will be short anyway. Good, so let's write this down. So h plus of t is 4 over r, gmc over c squared, 5/3. Then pi f, gravitational wave as a function of time, retarded time, over c, 2/3. Then the angular dependence cosine theta squared. And we have here the cosine phi of t. And h cross has the same amplitude. So this is the same, this is the same, this is the same. Everything is the same. We just have here a cosine. Oh, I put in an I here. I is now the inclination angle of the orbital plane. Sine phi of the retarded time. So we use now the solution we have for omega of t. Use solution for omega of t, or f of t, phi omega of t. We can plug it in. Then it follows that phi of tau is equal to minus 2. 5g the trap mass divided by c cubed to the power of minus 5 over 8 tau to the 5 over 8 plus an initial angle phi 0. So if you plug this one in, then h plus of t is equal 1 over r. G trap mass over c squared to the power of 5/4, and 5 over c tau to the power of 1 over 4. Again, the dependence on the inclination angle remains the same, and also this one here stays as it is. Okay, and h cross is the same. This is the same, this is the same, it has to be the same, this is also the same. And then we just have the cosine I and the sine phi of tau. Yeah, okay. So now we have two things. As a function of time, what is changing is the amplitude. So it goes like tau to the minus 1 over 4, right? So the amplitude increases with time. Slowly. What also changes is the phase, basically, which means it's the frequency, it's not the phase, the frequency changes. The frequency changes characteristically with tau to the 5, 8. Yeah? We can just plug it in and plot the solution as a function of tau or function of t. And then we find the following. So we plot h of t. Yeah, we basically, we can ignore this terms here or set it to some number. It doesn't really matter. So as a function of t, the whole thing looks like that. So we have then it slowly gets closer to each other, gets closer to each other, and then the amplitude increases and the frequency increases. So it goes up like this. So here the amplitude goes up and the frequency goes up. Yeah, and then here we have the plunge phase, the plunge time, T plunge. So amplitude and frequency increases, goes up with time. Yeah? And this is like a chirping bird. like a bird. Like a bird. So you can really also listen to those signals. I think there are some online links where you can listen to this gravitational wave signal. You can just put it on a loudspeaker, basically, and then you hear that its sound goes slowly with a few hertz, very deep. Whoop. Then it goes up and then it's done. Of course, it goes much faster. The last stage is in the range of, we are talking about milliseconds here, but we have seen the initial range is in the range of a few seconds or so. But then it's gone. Yeah. Also, LIGO has compared actually the time scale of the gravitational wave signal for the two neutron star mergers and the two black hole mergers they have seen. So the black hole mergers, they really start, whoop, and it's gone. This is all done within a fraction of a second or millisecond or so. But the two neutron stars gravitational wave signal, they see the signal, they see the signal, they see the signal, goes on and goes on and goes on and goes on. They have this animation online, and then finally it goes up and makes a trip mass. So this goes on much longer. Yeah. The interesting part is, of course, here, how the amplitude goes up, how the frequency goes with time. From this one can infer actually then the combination of the chirp mass and the distance by triangulation. So if you do triangulation, they find out the distance, and if they know the distance, then they can really precisely determine the chirp mass. Yeah, there is actually, if you look at this more careful, how the frequency changes with time only depends on the chirp mass. So if you look at how the frequency changes with time, then you can infer directly the chirp mass. Yeah. And from the amplitude, you can basically get a rough estimate on the distance already without really doing triangulation. Yeah, the triangulation just confirms where the whole thing comes from, but you don't need to do this. They only were able to do triangulation with the last event when Virgo went online. So they only had LIGO, so two detectors seeing something, but then they had Virgo. And with Virgo, they could really pinpoint down the event very precisely. Before that, it was just a slice in the hemisphere. But with Virgo, they could really pinpoint down the precise location. So in principle, if you go online and LIGO gives you the waveform, you can compute the chirp mass yourself, basically. This can be done. Good. So in the final few minutes, we have to talk about effects from GR. And most notably, we have to talk about the innermost stable circular orbit. Yeah, there is a natural cutoff, of course, from the innermost stable circular orbit, where we cannot say that the orbits are stable anymore, so our quasi-circular approximation breaks down. So, effect from GR, innermost stable circular orbit. The ISCO, ISCO, ISCO. So in Schwarzschild coordinates, we know what the ISCO is. What's the radius in Schwarzschild coordinate? R is go equal. x6gm over c squared. So it's a 3 times the Schwarzschild radius. Three times the Schwarzschild radius, and then the whole thing breaks down. So we have quasi-circular orbits for radii larger than r isco. So our expression is valid up to a certain point. Up to a frequency which is line up to ISCO is equal 1 over 6 square root of 6 2 pi c cubed over g m is around 2.2 kilohertz for a total mass in the range of one solar mass. So if we have two solar masses for the sum of the two neutron stars, we actually had 2.7 solar masses. So you see that there's a natural shutoff from quasi-circular motions already at a little bit values of a little bit below 1 kilohertz, which would be maybe 0.8 kilohertz would be the shutoff for the two neutron stars seen. So if we have GW170817, the total mass is around 2.7 solar masses. So this is around then. So FS ISCO. No, ISCO. Is about 0.8 kilohertz approximately, and for m of supermassive black holes, then FS ISCO is in the range of millihertz. Good. So the energy spectrum looks like this. dE over dF is equal pi to the 2/3 over 3g. G chirp mass to the 5/3. F to the minus 1/3. We just look at the expression we had for the power, yeah, and then recast it in terms of the frequency. Then it goes like F to the minus 1/3 and the chirp mass to the 5/3. We have seen that factor again. So we can integrate this one. up to F max. And then we get the energy emitted is around 4 times 2 times 10 to minus 2 solar masses C squared. Now I'm running out of space. For a chirp mass of 1.2 solar masses to the power of 5/3, and for F being F max of 1 kilohertz, which I omit. Yeah. So actually the energy release is huge. It's a few percent of the total mass of the star, yeah? Which is gigantic. If you think about, we did this exercise before. If we look at nuclear forces, then the binding energy of a nucleus is a few per mil. So this is an order of magnitude larger than any nuclear reactor can produce with one solar mass unit. So this is tenfold as much. So this energy release is actually gigantic. It's it's comparable actually to, let me see, it's nearly comparable to something like the binding energy of the neutron stars, not far off actually. So the binding energy of a neutron star is something like 10%. Here we're talking about 4%. Yeah. And the this is powering a supernova, 10 to 53 Ergs. So the energy release in gravitational waves is comparable to the energy release in a core collapse supernova and neutrinos. Yeah?
What actually happens to the energy that is in the gravitational wave, but it wriggles space-time and that's it, or is there any way to really get this energy back?
You want to get, okay, the question was, where's the energy going? Does it go back? Basically, as gravitational waves are so weakly interacting with ordinary matter, it just goes away. It just goes through the whole universe, it spreads out and basically dilutes with 1 over r in the amplitude. So, and then if we are lucky, we see some small wiggles in our apparatus, which is light years away. Yeah. But in order to see that, we need a huge energy release because they are so feebly interacting. So the problem is that the interaction goes with the gravitational constant G, and the gravitational constant G is 38 magnitudes smaller basically than compared to the nuclear forces. So it's really, really weakly interacting. Yeah. So one gets another estimate actually if one does looks at the binding energy of the two neutron stars at the ISCO. And this is an exercise one has usually done when looking at the Schwarzschild metric, just looking at the binding energy at the two neutron stars at the ISCO, you get something like 5.7 times 10 to minus 2, so similar binding energy in the ballpark of a few percent. Say 5% will be a typical number for the two neutron stars merging, released in energy. Okay, are there any more questions about the two neutron stars merging with each other? So if not, we will continue the next time looking at elliptic Keplerian orbits. So we get some corrections from the ellipticity, and then we look at the Fourier spectrum. Okay, see you next week.